Okay, today we're going to talk about the Cold War. We already mentioned it a bit when we finished up or wrapped up World War II. Like we said, that World War I was sort of the cause of World War II, or was, in fact, the cause of World War II. A lot of the end of World War II was actually the cause of the Cold War. Now, the first thing we need to do, though, is establish what exactly the Cold War was, because this is not at all a war in the traditional sense. This is a conflict that lasted from about 1945 to about 1992 between the United States and the Soviet Union, principally. Okay, we should know that the Soviet Union, or the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, also known as the USSR, is formerly known as Russia. Okay, during World War I, Russia underwent a revolution in which the communists seized power and transformed Russia from a monarchy to a communist state under the leadership of Vladimir Ilyich Lenin. Lenin transformed Russia into a communist state, and let's talk for a second, remind ourselves of what exactly communism is. In communism, the primary goal is to create a society in which everyone is completely equal. To accomplish this, the government seizes all private property. The government seizes the farms, the factories, homes, everything. Okay, and the government takes direct control over the entire economy. Land is redistributed, or it's collectivized, so that all of the privately owned farms are collectivized into large government-operated and government-run collectives, where the peasants work together to farm large state-owned farms. The factories are nationalized or taken over by the government, operated by the government bureaucracy, and the stores and retail operations and businesses are all government-owned. All prices are set by the government. And the principal goal here is to create a society in which everyone is completely equal. In order to accomplish this, it is by nature anti-democratic. Communist states are dictatorships, and they claim to be dictatorships. The dictatorship of the proletariat is how Marx said it. And essentially what this is supposedly, according to Marx, the proletariat or the working class would control the government through their representatives and their labor unions. But when the Bolsheviks, the guys who actually seized power in the Soviet Union, instituted this revolution, the Soviet Union got a hold of communist ideology, what they said is that the party bosses would actually run the state, that the heads of the Communist Party, who represented the proletariat, represented the workers, but the workers didn't really have much say. They believed that the workers on their own wouldn't really be able to organize this, that it had to be done by sort of the intellectuals or the leaders of the Communist Party. Okay, so that's communism in an overview. So what the Cold War is an ideological conflict. Okay, there is never any direct conflict between the United States and the Soviet Union. There's no actual fighting between the United States and the Soviet Union. There are lots and lots of indirect conflicts, however, that result from the Cold War. Famous examples, of course, are the Korean War and the Vietnam War. We'll talk more in depth about those in just a minute. But let's stick to this idea of sort of the difference between the capitalist and the communist system. I just went over what communism is all about, but let's look on the right-hand side of our screen at this column under communism. In a communist state, the economy is a command economy, meaning prices and production are set by the central government. Okay, the government decides how much of each product to make, and the government decides how much to charge for each of those products. Whereas in a capitalist system, supply and demand determines prices and production. The price of a good is set by the demand for that good. Individuals, individual store owners, individual retailers, individual wholesalers set prices at the highest level that people are willing to pay. Okay, so the market determines prices, the demand. People will pay a lot for things they really want, and they'll pay very little for things they don't really need. So price is set by how badly people want them, how much people are willing to pay. Production is also set by demand. If you can sell a product for a lot of money, then a lot of that product will be produced. If you cannot make very much money off of a product, then very little of that product will be produced. All of it is determined by individuals making individual decisions in order to maximize their own individual wealth. Okay? So prices and production are set by the market, and what we mean in practical terms is individual private stores and factory owners are making decisions based on how to maximize their own individual wealth. Okay? In the communist state, it's a socialist order. Okay? What that means is the central authority distributes houses, distributes food, distributes consumer goods being like things like clothing and appliances and toothbrushes, all that kind of stuff, based on the needs of the individual. Okay, the price of food, the price of consumer goods, and the price of everything, housing, is all determined by the central government and is set at a level so that everybody can afford it. Okay, whereas in a capitalist state, it's all determined by the free market. The price of housing is determined by the maximum amount that the land owner or the landlord can charge, and again, that is determined by how badly people want it and how much money they have available to spend on it. Okay. In a communist state, the government owns everything. Okay. In a capitalist state, mostly private ownership, though not 100%. The primary goal of communism is equality, whereas the primary goal of capitalism is freedom. Now, with the conclusion of World War II, an iron curtain, as we say in metaphor, descended across Europe. Okay, I want you to think back about the end of World War II. Remember that the Soviets invaded Germany from the east, while the United States, the French, the Canadians, and the British invaded Germany from the west. So the two forces, the Soviets coming in from the east and the other allies coming in from the west, met in Germany. Half of Germany was occupied by the Soviets, the other half was occupied by the British, the Americans, the French. Now, at the conclusion of the war, Germany was divided into occupational zones, four different occupational zones. One zone for the Soviets, one zone for the Americans, one zone for the French, and one zone for the British. Very quickly, the Americans, the British, and the French decided to combine their zones into one country, which eventually was granted its independence as West Germany. The Soviets maintained control of East Germany, and it eventually became the communist country of the Democratic Republic of East Germany, I believe was its official name. It was a communist country. As the Soviets invaded Eastern Europe in order to attack the Nazis, they occupied all of the countries of Eastern Europe. So if you look at your map, you can see the results of this. All of Eastern Europe, all of the countries that were liberated from the Nazis by the Soviets, became communist countries after World War II ended. Okay, so if you look real close at your map and we look at Europe, you see the red countries in Eastern Europe. These are the countries of Poland, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia, Romania, Bulgaria, Albania, all became communists. Okay, you'll notice that some of them are bright red. Those are the ones that are directly allied with the Soviet Union, and some of them are kind of a gray color with a red star in them. And that those are countries that are communist but weren't actually allied with the Soviet Union. So Eastern Europe became communist, while Western Europe went on a capitalist democratic path. Okay, the countries of Western Europe had been democracies before the war and continued to be democracies after the war. They also adhered to a generally capitalist system. Now, it's important to understand that they did have some socialist aspects to their government. Now, when I talk about socialism versus communism, what we're really talking about here is degree. Okay, when communists are institute socialism 100%. Okay, so if we talk about a country being communist, what we're saying is they have completely and 100% transformed their economy into a socialist economy. The government has taken control of all private property. Government has taken control of all industry. Government has taken control of all of the farms. Government has taken control of all transportation. Government has taken control of all business. Okay, so that's a communist country. But the act of government taking over certain industries is socialism. Okay? So an extreme form of socialism is communism. Okay? But a country could institute some socialist policies. For example, in France, in Britain, in Norway, in West Germany, and in many other countries in Western Europe, as well as in South America and Canada, there were major socialist policies instituted. For one, nationalized health care. Okay? If we lived in Western Europe today, our health care would be provided to us free by the government, or at a very, very low cost by the government. Countries like Canada and France and Norway, hospitals are all government-run. Doctors all work for the government. It's a government institution. Okay? Government controls health care. Government owns health care, okay, that industry. The airlines in many European countries were nationalized. The railroads were nationalized. The railroad in our country is actually nationalized. Freight railroad. The freight is privately owned, but the railroad Amtrak, the passenger railroad in our country, is actually government owned. Amtrak is a government agency, although it sort of has some private aspects to it, but for the most part it's government owned. So we have some socialist aspects. Our post office is government owned. The railroads, the passenger railroads in the United States, are government owned. Though that's really the extent of it in our country. It was much more extensive, though, in Western Europe. So this divide as far as capitalism versus communism, and saying that in communist countries the government owns major industries and in capitalist countries it's all privately owned. We can't say that because it's much more gray than that. In some capitalist countries, major industries like coal mining, steel production, transportation are government owned, like France. Okay, I believe Norway as well, most of the major industries are government owned. Whereas in a country like ours, very few industries are government owned. Okay, so there's degrees here. But what is generally true, as a sort of definite rule between the difference between capitalism and communism, is this idea of a command economy versus supply and demand. In a communist country, prices in production are definitely set by the central authority, and it's 100% government ownership. Whereas in a capitalist country, supply and demand sets prices, and government ownership depends on the extent to which that capitalist country institutes socialist policies. Okay, so we understand, hopefully, now that there are distinct differences between the red countries on your map and the blue countries on your map, but there's also a considerable amount of gray area, okay, meaning that they do share some commonalities. Okay, capitalism isn't one way and capitalism another. They tend to overlap in some ways. Okay, so during the Cold War, what basically happens is the United States becomes big man on campus for the capitalists and the capitalist-leaning countries of the world, okay, which are all the blue countries on your map. The dark blue countries are our direct allies. They formed a military alliance with us called NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. This still exists today. It was formed during the Cold War, and it was a military alliance of capitalists and capitalist-leaning countries formed by the United States to protect all of its members from Soviet aggression. Okay, and what NATO said was an attack on one is an attack on all. So the United States and its strongest allies are the dark blue countries. Okay, and then the United States formed allies with other countries, which are these lighter blue countries. Okay, these countries were capitalist leaning. Okay, or purely capitalist, depending on the situation. Some of them were also democracies, though that was not universally true. Because you're capitalist does not mean you're a democracy. Okay, and the United States formed many allies during the Cold War that were not democracies. Okay, in popular understanding, what you will hear is that the Cold War was the battle of democracy versus communism, or democracy versus dictatorship. No, 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 no. That's not what it was about at all. Okay, if you'll look at your map and think a little bit about what you know, you'll see blue countries on this map that you should know were not democracies. The best example I can think of right off the top of my head is Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia, we learned, was ruled by the Saud family. Okay, going way back to the Ottoman Empire, it was ruled by the Saud family. It's still ruled by the Saud family. It didn't have elections then, and it doesn't have elections now. But it was definitely an ally of the United States. So, again, the blue countries on your map are the allies of the United States. They're capitalist or they're capitalist-leaning. Okay, they tend to be more capitalist than they are socialist. Okay, and they're either direct military allies who form NATO, which is this military alliance in which everyone promises to defend each other, or they're allied through other means or other treaties. Okay, then on the other side we have what we call the Second World or the Communist Bloc. Okay, the Communist Bloc is the big man on campus. There is the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union formed a military alliance called the Warsaw Pact. Okay, it was the Soviet Union's answer to NATO, and it included the Soviet Union and the countries of Eastern Europe, including Poland, Czechoslovakia, Romania, and Bulgaria. So the Warsaw Pact is a military alliance to defend the communist world from the capitalists. Okay, and these two worlds are very dramatically divided by what we call the Iron Curtain. The Iron Curtain is a metaphor to describe how intense the divide actually was. Winston Churchill, the Prime Minister of Britain during World War II, came up with that term. And the reason he used it was because it was like somebody had pulled a curtain across Europe, and now there was just no communication between the two. The Soviet world, the communist world led by the Soviet Union, had its own economic system, had its own economic exchange, had its own cultural exchange, had, you know, its own travel. You know, people were friends and traveling around in these countries, but had very little contact or communication with any of the blue countries. And the blue countries had very little contact or communication with any of the red countries. It was like there were two completely separate worlds. And that's actually where we get the term first world being the capitalist countries, second world, the communist countries, and then the third world is everybody else, okay, who hasn't chosen a side yet, which is sort of the gray countries on your map, but not 100%, okay? Now, what I want you to notice here is how extensive communism was. A lot of students this day and age look back and learn about the Cold War, and they can't figure out why people my age and older were scared. Because when I was a kid, even though it was in the towards the very end of the Cold War, I mean, the Cold War was really coming to an end when I was a child, but I definitely remember it. I remember the Soviet Union, and I remember being scared that the Soviet Union might actually attack us, that we might actually go into World War III, this horrible, horrible war, the United States versus the Soviet Union, or that the Soviet Union might try and invade us, or that the Soviet Union might spread communism all over the world. Now, for students your age, that seems completely unrealistic. Okay, because communism has been such a complete failure in the world. The few communist countries that are left in the world are really only communist in name today, okay, not in practice. They call themselves communist, but they don't follow any of the communist economic policies. But if you look at this map, and this is from the 70s, I think this map is accurate for the 70s, you can see just how extensive communism was, how many countries had become communist. The Soviet Union, obviously. Eastern Europe, we already discussed. But look where else. Mongolia, China, Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, North Korea, Yemen, Ethiopia, Angola, the Congo, Mozambique, Cuba. And then you have not only these countries that have truly become communist, then you have the sort of light red countries, which are, though they're not totally socialist or communist, they're still allied with the Soviet Union, they're still friends with the Soviet Union, they have some socialist-leaning tendencies. And then, look at all the little red dots in the world, okay? All countries that have very active communist movements within them. They haven't managed to seize power yet, but they're strongly pushing for communism, okay? So it was very real that the communists were actually spreading all over the world, and there was actually a chance they might win. So, as a result, the United States instituted a policy that we call containment. Okay, it came from Truman. It's also known as the Truman Doctrine. And containment was based on the ideas of one of our secretaries of state, I think. And what he basically said, I can't remember his name right now, but what he said was that communism, the system, holds within it the seeds of decay. Okay, it's a system destined to fail. It will not work in the long run, is what he said. Keenan is the guy's name that came up with this. George Keenan, I think his first name is George. But at any rate, he comes up with this idea that communism will fail with time. The system will not stand the test of time. So what the United States decides to do is to wait it out. We will not take the communists on directly. We will not fight the Soviets directly. Okay, it's not the communists, it's the Soviets we don't want to fight. We will not fight the Soviets directly. Instead, we'll just wait out communism, wait for the system to fail. In the meantime, we're going to stop the spread of communism. Our goal as the United States was to stop communism from spreading to any other countries. So imagine, like, if you had a wasp flying around the room, a big, scary wasp, okay? And the wasp landed right in front of you. And all you have is your bare hand. Well, you can squash the wasp, okay, and kill it, but you might get stung, and it might be really nasty, okay? Or you can simply contain it, okay? Imagine you could take a glass, okay? Let's say you had a glass, and turn it upside down and set it over the wasp, okay? And you let the wasp buzz around inside the glass until it just dies, okay? You decided, I don't want to try and fight with this wasp because it might sting me. Instead, I'm just going to contain it inside this glass and wait for it to die. That's what we did with communism, okay, is we tried to contain the spread, stop the spread of communism. Okay, I realize this is going to be a long one, but let's go ahead and transition to the next slide, please. Okay, I'm not going to read through this whole thing in detail because I think, for the most part, it's relatively self-explanatory. But what I do want to make some basic summaries. One, George Keenan was right. Capitalism succeeded, and communism did hold within it the seeds of decay. So on the right-hand side of your screen here, you have the second world, which is the communist world. What we had was immediately a tremendous amount of success, okay? Rapid industrialization, rapid development of heavy industry. But as time progressed, inefficiency, lack of organization, and lack of sufficient goods, consumer goods, lack of agricultural goods, unreliable farming. So at first it was great, but very quickly the bureaucracy that had managed it all became quite inefficient, and there was shortages of goods, both food and consumer. Whereas in the first world, which is the capitalist world and the capitalist-leaning world, the blue countries, things were really good. The United States made tons and tons of money after World War II. We really benefited tremendously. World War II, the war itself, brought us out of the Depression. It created 100% employment. All the men went off and fought in the war. The women entered the factories. Massive industrialization, massive output. We made tons of money selling stuff to our allies. And the soldiers who were off fighting earned all kinds of money, which they squirreled away in the bank. And these women who were working in the factories during the war earned all kinds of money, which they squirreled away in the bank because they didn't have anything to spend it on during the war. During the war, there was rationing, and all the factories were producing things for the war effort. So as a result, you had large numbers of women working. You had large numbers of men in the military, all of them earning paychecks, but not really having much to spend the money on, so therefore they were saving it. When the war ended, all these people had all this extra money, and so the factories turned from producing stuff for the military to producing stuff for all these people to buy. So it was a consumer explosion. They started producing all kinds of stuff, clothing, appliances, cars, houses, so houses like mad, built all over the country. So a consumer explosion. So lots and lots of money, economic growth like mad in the United States. The United States takes this economic growth and pours it into Western Europe as part of their containment policy. What we figure in Western Europe is if we can get Western Europe's economy back on its feet and get Western Europe developed fast enough, then they won't even think twice about becoming communist because the capitalist world has helped them recover so quickly. So the United States pours billions and billions, $20 billion into the countries of Western Europe, France, Britain, Ireland, West Germany, Italy, Iceland, all of these Western European countries, pours all kinds of money in to help rebuild the country after the war and then develop their economies. It's tremendously successful. Europe recovers very quickly. Then add to that the European countries form what's called the European Community. It's a European Economic Community. Basically, what they do is they make Europe one big free trade zone. What that means is you can manufacture something in France and ship it and sell it in Germany, and you don't have to pay any taxes for shipping the goods over the border. So this is really good for business. So this free trade zone that develops in Europe, which is called the European Community, helps spur further growth. As a result, wages increase, social benefits increase, like healthcare improves, education improves, public education, public healthcare improve, unemployment decreases, and Europe becomes a mass consumer society, much like the United States. So the second world starts good, then seems to be doing bad. The first world starts slow, but then ends up doing really, really terrific. Okay? So let's go ahead and transition to the next slide. Okay, let's talk through some of the major conflicts of the Cold War. Okay? The first major conflict of the Cold War never resulted in any fighting, but this is the first time we came close to fighting. The United States followed a policy of what we call brinkmanship, although I think that technically this comes a little later on, but that we would go just to the brink of war, but we really wanted to avoid actual war. Now, let's first talk about why we really, 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 really tried to avoid actual conflict with the Soviet Union. We had developed the atomic bomb, okay, in 1944, I think, which is the bomb that we dropped in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Shortly after the United States developed the atomic bomb, the Soviet Union likewise developed the atomic bomb. Then the United States the Soviet Union developed their first and exploded their first atomic device in 1949. So both the United States and the Soviet Union had atomic bombs, these weapons capable of mass destruction. Then in 1952, the United States developed the hydrogen bomb. Okay, the hydrogen bomb, okay, let me give you an idea here. The atomic bomb, which is the type of bomb that we dropped in Hiroshima, had the destructive power of 12,500 tons of TNT or dynamite. Okay, so the bomb that we dropped in Hiroshima had the explosive power of 12,000 tons of dynamite. Okay, the hydrogen bomb had the explosive power of several million tons of dynamite, okay? So it was incredibly more destructive, the hydrogen bomb. Imagine it this way. If you dropped the bomb that we dropped in Hiroshima in downtown Atlanta, it would, right on, you know, Five Points MARTA station, it would destroy a circle out to about the Atlanta University Center, okay? If you can imagine that Atlanta University Center is about 3 or 4, maybe 5 miles from downtown, all of that would be destroyed, okay? People maybe out to College Park, probably not quite that far, would get radiation poisoning. I don't think they would in College Park, though. I think that's pretty far. Now, drop a hydrogen bomb on the city of Atlanta, the bomb that we developed in 1952. It would pretty much kill everybody inside the perimeter, okay, inside 285, if you can imagine that huge circle. Most of those people would pretty much be dead, okay? And people would die of radiation poisoning as far away as Alabama, okay? So incredibly more destructive. Add to that that we put these bombs now on missiles, okay? So no longer, like in World War II, do we have to fly an airplane and drop the bomb out of an airplane, now we can actually launch it from American soil and it'll fly through the air and blow up in the Soviet Union. Okay, these weapons are incredibly destructive. Okay, and as a result, the United States and the Soviet Union, the fact that both the United States and the Soviet Union possessed them, because shortly after we detonated that hydrogen bomb in 1952, the Soviets detonated their own hydrogen bomb. Okay, so we both possessed the same technology. We both possessed missiles capable of launching them. Okay, as a result, we ended up with what we call mutually assured destruction. We knew that if we launched our weapons on the Soviet Union, that the Soviet Union would have time to launch their weapons on us. We would be completely dead, and they would be completely dead. Okay, or almost completely dead. Probably not completely, but almost completely dead. We knew that we could just about completely destroy them, and they knew that they could just about completely destroy us. And most importantly, we knew that if we launched our weapons, they were going to want to launch theirs. And there was no way for us to stop the weapons. Okay, this became incredibly true, I guess. It sounds weird, but this became incredibly important with the addition of these missiles called ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles, to submarines. When the United States did it first and was followed shortly after by the Soviet Union, put these missiles on submarines, it really, really made sure of mutually assured destruction. Because now there was no way to shoot the missiles down. If the missiles were, you know, fixed, if the Soviet Union knew the missiles were coming from the United States, then they could put up anti-missile missiles, okay? They could potentially shoot the missiles out of the air before they hit the Soviet Union. Well, if they're on submarines, then you don't know where they're coming from, because the submarines could be anywhere in the world. So the missiles could come from the east, they could come from the west, they could come from the south. Who knows where they're going to come from? So there's no way to defend against them. The Soviets had their missiles on submarines. We had ours on submarines. We both knew we could completely wipe out the other, or just about completely wipe out the other. So as a result, none of the Cold War conflicts resulted in direct conflict between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Okay, so let's go through these. The first, the Berlin blockade. When Germany was partitioned, was divided up into those four sections, the capital city of Germany, Berlin, was located in the Soviet zone. The city of Berlin itself was also divided into four occupational zones. The Soviets got Eastern Berlin, the United States, the British, and the French got West Berlin. One road, and I think two railroad tracks, linked West Berlin to West Germany, because West Berlin, even though it was in East Germany, was the capital of West Germany. Okay. Or was a city in West Germany. I'm not 100% sure it was the capital, but I think it was. So you actually had to travel through East Germany to get to West Berlin, even though West Berlin was part of West Germany. The Soviets wanted to test the Americans, and so they blockaded Berlin. They were hoping to drive the Americans, the French, and the British out of Berlin so that Berlin would become completely a part of East Germany. So they cut off access. They cut off the road and they cut off the railroads into Berlin. So West Berlin was left isolated with no supplies, no food, no nothing. And what the Soviets hoped was that we would be so scared of starting a war with the Soviets that we would just give up, and the people of West Berlin would be forced to turn to the Soviets for help, and West Berlin would become a part of East Germany. Okay? Well, the United States wouldn't let that happen. So the United States and the British organized the Berlin Airlift. Airplanes took off like every 10 seconds, loaded with supplies of food and fuel and everything that the people of West Berlin needed, and delivered those supplies to West Berlin for several months. Okay, so rather than sending an army in to open up the road or the railroad, which would bring us in direct conflict with the Soviets, we just simply used airplanes to fly the supplies into West Berlin. And we did it for several months until finally the Soviets gave up and they allowed West Berlin to remain a part of West Germany. Okay, so that was the first conflict. You can see a picture of the Berlin Airlift in the bottom right-hand corner. Next was the construction of the Berlin Wall. By the as time progressed, it became clear that life in the West Germany and life in West Berlin was considerably better than life in East Germany and life in East Berlin. The Soviets had not been nearly as aggressive in rebuilding East Germany and East Berlin as the Americans, the British, and the French had been in rebuilding West Germany and West Berlin. So the people of East Berlin really didn't like living there, and so they wanted to leave. So, in large numbers, people simply packed up and left East Berlin and moved to West Berlin. Well, that really made the East Germans look bad, that their own people wanted to leave. So, they constructed the Berlin Wall. Okay, the Berlin Wall was essentially a very large, tall wall that ran right through the middle of Berlin. And it was intended not to keep people out, but actually to keep people in. The East German government built the Berlin Wall in 1961. So again, the intent of the wall was to keep the East Berliners in East Berlin. What's really interesting here is if you can look at the picture in the upper left-hand corner, you can see the construction of the Berlin Wall. And if you can kind of look through the letters here, you can actually see the West Berliners standing there watching. So you can imagine it must have been a strange situation to be standing that close to your enemy, watching them construct a wall in between you. Okay. So that wall remained up until 1992, I believe, was when it was torn down. Next, the Korean War. At the conclusion of World War II, Korea was a Japanese colony. Okay, remember that Korea had belonged to the Japanese before World War II and, of course, remained part of Japan through the war. Well, Japan lost control of its colonies as a result of losing World War II. The Soviets occupied North Korea and the Americans occupied South Korea. They could not figure out how to compromise on unifying the country, so what ultimately resulted was that Korea became two separate countries. North Korea had a communist government South Korea had a capitalist democratic government. Okay? And so at the conclusion of World War II, Korea became two separate countries, North Korea and South Korea, North Korea being communist. In 1950, the North Korean communists invaded South Korea to try and reunify the country under a communist government. The United States went to the United Nations. The United Nations voted to condemn the North Koreans and ask the members of the United Nations to come to the aid of the South Koreans. Now, think about this, because you should have learned already about the United Nations. The Soviets had veto power, but the Soviets and the Communist Chinese had veto. Well, I'm sorry. It gets confusing. Okay, remember there were five permanent members of the UN Security Council, all of which had the power to veto any decision made by the United Nations. The five permanent members were the British, the French, the Americans, the Soviets, and the Chinese. Okay. But remember that China had just fought a civil war. So there were essentially two Chinese governments. The Communist Chinese government that controlled mainland China under Mao Zedong, and the Chinese nationalists, the Kuomintang, which now was on the island of Taiwan under the leadership of Chiang Kai-shek. The United States, the British, and the French bullied the United Nations Security Council, the world in general, into recognizing the Chinese nationalists on Taiwan and Chiang Kai-shek's government as the official Chinese government. So the permanent seat on the Security Council held by China was being held by the Chinese nationalist government in Taiwan under Chiang Kai-shek instead of the Chinese communist government on the mainland held by Mao Zedong. Now, this was absolutely ridiculous because we've already learned that Chiang Kai-shek had lost the Chinese Civil War and was hiding out on this little old island off the coast of China. And so he clearly had lost, and it was very clear that the legitimate government of China was now the communist government of Mao Zedong. But we were holding on to the idea that it was the Chinese nationalists on Taiwan. So it was this really stupid thing where we had managed to manipulate the Chinese nationalists into having the permanent seat on the Security Council. Well, the Soviets thought that was about the stupidest thing they'd ever heard, so they just boycotted the United Nations. They just stopped going because they said, this is stupid. Obviously, the legitimate government of China is Mao Zedong's communist government, but y'all are recognizing Chiang Kai-shek's little tiny government on the island of Taiwan as a legitimate government, and you're giving them the permanent seat on the Security Council. So this is dumb. We're not playing. So at that moment in time, the UN Security Council was the United States, the British, the French, the Chinese from Taiwan, which was Chiang Kai-shek's nationalist government, which was allied with the United States, and then a couple other random people. So that Security Council voted to send the United Nations army into South Korea to defend South Korea from the North Korean communists. So the Korean War was actually a UN operation, but it was mostly the United States defending South Korea, and the Chinese defending North Korea. So it was a war of the North Koreans versus the South Koreans, with the U.S. helping South Korea and the Chinese helping North Korea. It ultimately resulted in a return to two separate Koreas. North Korea was driven out of South Korea, and the original border between North and South Korea was reestablished at the 38th parallel, which is the line of latitude. The 38th parallel being the line, a line of latitude. And so North and South Korea again became two separate independent countries, and North Korea is communist, South Korea capitalist democracy. Now, they never signed a peace treaty. They still haven't. They're still technically at war, but they haven't fought since 1953. So they stopped fighting in 1953 and just sort of agreed to live and let live, though they never actually formally concluded the war. So the Korean War was a success. We stopped the spread of communism. Remember, our goal is containment, to stop the spread. We went into South Korea to stop communism from spreading into South Korea. Essentially, the same thing happened in Vietnam. Remember that Vietnam, before World War II, was a French colony, the French colony of French Indochina. The Japanese had invaded it and taken it over. And so after World War II, the French reoccupied Vietnam and reestablished French Indochina. Meanwhile, a anti-colonial revolution began in Vietnam, headed by a guy named Ho Chi Minh, okay, with a considerable amount of support from the Chinese government. Ho Chi Minh and his army, called the Viet Minh, fought the French to drive the French out of Vietnam. And in 1954, the French stronghold, or the French outpost in Vietnam of Dien Bien Phu, fell. Okay, city of Dien Bien Phu, the last place where the French were able to hold on in Vietnam, fell in 1953. So with the fall of Dien Bien Phu, Vietnam became an independent country. Ho Chi Minh was a communist, okay? And Ho Chi Minh went about to establish a communist government in North Vietnam. Meanwhile, South Vietnam established a capitalist government that was very corrupt and disorganized, okay? So Vietnam, sort of like Korea, had divided into a communist North and a sort of capitalist South, okay? Well, just like the North Koreans invaded South Korea, the North Vietnamese invaded South Vietnam. Just like the United States went in to help the South Vietnamese, the South Koreans, the United States went in to help the South Vietnamese. Again, a goal, containment. Stop the spread of communism. Stop the communism from spreading from North Vietnam to South Vietnam. Unfortunately, it was a very long, very drawn-out war that was ultimately, in the end, unsuccessful, lasting when the United States started, when we initially went in, Dien Bien Phu fell in 1954, so the U.S. started to get involved then, and we finally continued until 1973. I mean, we didn't actually have direct military involvement right after Dien Bien Phu, but we sort of started getting interested in the situation, and then finally in 1973 we called it quits. and signed a treaty with the North Vietnamese in which they agreed not to take over South Vietnam. But 2 years later, in 1975, the North Vietnamese invaded South Vietnam and made Vietnam into a communist country, capturing the capital of South Vietnam, Saigon, and renaming it Ho Chi Minh City. Okay, so Vietnam became communist. So in this case, we were not able to stop the spread of communism. Now here we were particularly worried because we were afraid of a domino effect. We were afraid that if Vietnam fell to the communists, then Laos and Cambodia would fall as well. Turned out we were right. Laos and Cambodia very quickly also became communist countries. Okay, so that was the Vietnam War. Next, the closest we probably came to direct conflict between the United States and the Soviet Union was the Cuban Missile Crisis. Okay, Cuba had become a communist country. A guy named Che Guevara, with the help of a guy named Fidel Castro, who you've probably heard of, managed to overthrow the pretty corrupt government, though very friendly to the United States government, of Cuba, and establish a communist government. Now, when Castro initially went in, he wasn't particularly devoutly communist, but he got so much support from the Soviet Union that he became very, very communist as time progressed. And so Cuba became a communist country under Fidel Castro. The United States had extremely extensive economic interests in Cuba. Most of the hotels in Cuba was a huge tourist destination for Americans, and most of the hotels and resorts were American-owned. So when Cuba fell to the communists and all these hotels were nationalized or taken over by the Cuban government, the United States was really ticked off. And the Cuban middle class, who had been the beneficiaries of U.S. investment in Cuba, were equally ticked off, and they took off and left and moved to Miami. And as a result, there is an extremely large Cuban population still today living in Miami. The United States tried to work with this Cuban population to overthrow Fidel Castro and overthrow the communist government of Cuba. Our president, John F. Kennedy, ordered the CIA to help the Cubans living in Miami organize an invasion of Cuba and a revolution to overthrow Castro. This army, trained and armed by the CIA, did invade Cuba and was immediately defeated at the Bay of Pigs, and we call this the Bay of Pigs fiasco. The United States trains and arms this army of Cubans, sends them down to invade Cuba, and the Cuban army crushes them immediately. And so it was a big embarrassment, and it made the Cuban government, Fidel Castro, very angry. So Fidel buddied up real close with the Soviet Union's premier at the time, whose name was Khrushchev, and Khrushchev sent nuclear missiles to Cuba, placed Soviet nuclear missiles in Cuba. The United States spy satellites and spy planes, actually I think they were spy planes at the time, saw the missiles, realized they were there, and freaked out and went to the United Nations and confronted the Soviet Union. And we came very, very close to actual military conflict with the Soviet Union and perhaps the launching of missiles. The movie 13 Days tells the story of this. It's an excellent movie. I strongly, 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 strongly recommend that you watch it. Ultimately, in the end, the United States and the Soviet Union were more scared of armed conflict than they were of losing their face. And so the Soviets quietly removed the missiles from Cuba, and the United States quietly removed nuclear missiles from Turkey. So we both had to give. The Soviets pulled their missiles out of Cuba, and we pulled missiles out of Turkey. So it wasn't like, we both had to back down, basically. Okay, and what it proved at this point was that armed conflict was just too dangerous, and really that the fear of mutually assured destruction was going to keep us from actually going to war. Then in the 1979, we got the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. When the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, it was very similar to the situation in Vietnam. The Soviets were trying to prop up a weak communist government in Afghanistan. The United States was funneling money and weapons to an anti-communist insurgents in Afghanistan. You can see a picture of this on the right-hand side in the center. That shoulder-launched rocket that guy has is actually an American-made Stinger missile. The U.S. funneled this stuff in to help the Afghans fight the Soviets. Incidentally, this Mujahideen, as they were called, these are the anti-communist fighters in Afghanistan, eventually became the Taliban, which is interesting that we actually armed the Taliban during the Cold War, and then they came back to fight with us later on afterwards. But Afghanistan can be thought of as the Soviet Union's Vietnam. They got bogged down there, and it was disastrous for them. Now, those are the main conflicts, but then there's also this whole other thing, the space race. So we're, you know, in these conflicts with the Soviets all over the world, and we're also fighting with them not physically but technologically in space. The Soviets get the upper hand first by launching Sputnik, which is the satellite on the bottom left-hand corner of your screen. That ball looks like a basketball with antennas on it, a silver basketball with antennas. Sputnik was launched by the Soviets in October of 1957. It was the first satellite to orbit the Earth. 3 months later, the United States launched a satellite. And then, ultimately, the United States beat out the Soviets in 1969 when we landed Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin on the moon. And the United States made it to the moon before the Soviets. But the space race was sort of the realization of Cold War technology. Like, we were pushing our scientists to develop better and better technology. So the Soviets launched a satellite first. Then we launched the Soviets put dog in space. They set a rocket up with dogs, and the dogs came back alive. So, okay. Then we put monkeys in space. And then the Soviets put a man in space. And then we put a man on the moon. And so it was this conflict. So a byproduct of the Cold War conflict was major advances in science and technology. Okay, so that finishes it up for today.